This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, Republican lawmakers released their proposed maps for Wisconsin's legislative districts this week. We'll find out what they look like, who benefits, and the coming court challenges. Now on this week's edition of Food Friday, a side dish takes the starring role. Potatoes are one of the most versatile foods out there, and our next guest has lots of ideas and recipes, along with some general advice on making great dinners at home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you like to prepare potatoes and or eat said potatoes? Roasted, fried, braised, baked, twice baked, mashed? Love to hear your recipes, your advice. Do you have a favorite kind of potato? Do you have a question for our guest about what goes wrong maybe when making a potato dish? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Molly Stevens is a Vermont-based cooking teacher, recipe developer, editor, and cookbook author whose books include All About Roasting, One Potato, Two Potato, and her most recent All About Dinner, Simple Meals, Expert Advice. Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, it's one of your older cookbooks, but you did a whole book about potatoes. What gets you excited about potatoes that you could put that much effort and love into them?
Yeah, it's a big book, too. It's over 300 recipes. Yeah, you know, Rob, when I I co-authored the book with a good friend of mine, Roy Finnemore, and when he actually came up with the idea for the book, I took a moment and said, really, a whole book on potatoes? Because I love potatoes, always have, but I was a little concerned that I might tire of them after, you know, a year and a half or so that it takes to develop all those recipes. But I have to tell you, Rob, I love them more after I wrote the book than before.
Do you have a favorite variety of potato to cook with? Or is it, you know, mission dependent? You like this kind of potato for that, this kind of potato for that?
It's a little of both. I mean, my favorite one is the one that's on my kitchen counter that's about to become dinner. But the variety, that's exactly, I think, what really turned me on to the potential of potatoes. Is when I first started thinking about it, I was like, well, there's a red potato and a white potato and a russet potato. But once you really delve into it, my goodness, it goes on and on in terms of varieties. And more as our farmers markets and specialty markets and even just regular supermarkets expand the variety that's available. And they all, you know, they have different tastes, they have different characteristics, and yet they're incredibly forgiving. I mean, you don't have to like have just this special potato for this special dish, but it's really fun to kind of go down a potato rabbit hole, if you will.
And stepping aside from potatoes, I mean, potatoes are a good fit for this. In All About Dinner, you make the case that the point that really good home-cooked meals don't have to be incredibly complicated and fussy. Can you talk a little bit about your philosophy of dinners?
You know, I've been cooking for a long time, and I've taught cooking for a long time at a lot of different venues, and you know, the simplest way to learn how to cook is to cook. And the simplest way to cook is to make a meal for yourself or your household or whoever you have, your neighbor, whoever you happen to be around. And I mean, something as simple as baking a potato, boiling an egg, frying an egg, doing something, just that simple act of cooking doesn't have to be complicated. And you feed yourself and you discover things and you learn things. I don't know, it develops a self-sufficiency. I can't say enough about how much better things can be if we learn to cook for ourselves.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about potatoes with cookbook author Molly Stevens, author of books including One Potato, Two Potato, and her most recent All About Dinner, Simple Meals, Expert Advice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite kind of potato, a favorite way to cook potatoes or recipe, or do you need some advice? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can find some recipes from our guest over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's, Molly, check one of those out now. It's party potatoes, a mashed potato that is a crowd pleaser. Can you tell us what makes this one special?
Yeah, party potatoes. And I chose that recipe for now because we're kind of gearing up for the holidays, and it's one that I do for the holidays because it's, you know, mashed potatoes are a given on a lot of holiday tables. Maybe on yours, Rob? Maybe.
Oh, yeah. No, I like making mashed potatoes with some pratfalls. Yeah. I'll ask you about in a minute. But
Oh, good. So anyway, party potato is it's a mashed potato casserole, if you will, meaning you can make it ahead. And that's why it really works for me and my situation. I can make it ahead and take it to where I'm going for Thanksgiving. And it gets enriched with a few little extra things, cream cheese being one of them, that adds both a really great tang, but it also gives you this incredible creamy, fluffy, if those two go together, texture that lasts. Because the problem with mashed potatoes, if they sit around too long, they can just kind of get gluey. But yeah, this party potato dish, it's a make-ahead casserole, and you can actually use your KitchenAid blender or any mixer to make it. And then I the party potato version is pretty straightforward seasonings-wise, but I play around with it and add horseradish or scallions or all sorts of things, just depending on, you know, what way you want to go with that menu.
And you just teased my pratfall. Usually my mashed potatoes come out great, but every once in a while they get, I don't know, like oversaturated or something. And like you said, they end up kind of gluey. How can I make sure I never, ever do that again?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are a couple things. The first is going back to those types of potato. The best potato for a mashed potato, the classic, I should say. I want to say the best because there's different ways. But the classic is a russet, an Idaho. I don't know, they go by different things in different parts of the country. But it's the big old baking potato, a big starchy, dry potato. And what makes those so great for mashed potatoes is they're super starchy, which means they're super thirsty. So they love to absorb as much butter and milk and sour cream and heavy cream, whatever you want to throw at them. So they're a great vehicle for a lot of enrichment. If you're do you know, Rob, when they haven't worked well for you, what type of potato you used?
I think it might have been russet, but it's been a while since I botched them that badly, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah.
Mostly I'm doing pretty good lately.
Good. I love to use a ricer, which is kind of an old-fashioned tool for mashing the potatoes, and that helps to get a really fluffy texture. Mm. Another really great tip for getting a really dry mashed potato is after. So you boil the potato, right? And then you drain it. And then put the back on the stove in that pan without any fat, without anything, and sort of shake them around for a little bit. And really dry them out before you start adding things. Oh. Because if they're not really dry and you try to add things, they're just going to end up soupy and, as you say, maybe even a little bit gluey. So I tend to peel and chunk them in big chunks, like, you know, baseball, golf ball size chunks, not too small, before I boil them. And then as soon as they're, you know, tender, drain them, put them back in the pot, low heat, and just really shake that pot around. And you'll see a film of starchy potato film on the bottom of the pan, and that's a sign that you've got them really, really dry. Then you can start to mash them and slowly add your enrichments.
Excellent. Well, let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Timothy is with us in southern Minnesota. Timothy, hi.
Hi. Hi, Molly. Huge fan of One Potato and also All About Roasting and All About Braising. My question is, I know you've had a lot of students over the years, and you've worked with a lot of at-home cooks, and you were talking about how experience can really, is kind of the number one thing that can help people become better cooks. Are there other things that people can do that would kind of help them accelerate, or become more confident in the kitchen?
Hey, Timothy.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Molly.
Yeah. No, thanks for calling. Yeah, what can help besides experience? Reading. I'm a big fan of reading cookbooks, finding cookbooks you love, and then sort of following the thread of those cookbooks. You know, there's so much online right now that I find it's remarkable how much you can find. And also, you know, friends. I find sharing with friends who like to cook, and I know it's, you know, been difficult over the past couple how long it's been, but year or so that we've been able to get together. But even if it's we do these potlucks where you know, somebody cooks something and then somebody else brings something and you sort of swap recipes that way. So that's how I help, you know, advance my own, you know, creativity is by sort of surrounding myself with friends or reaching out to other friends or I try something. I say, how'd you make that? Or if you are at a restaurant, you know, to ask questions. And also, I don't know where you shop, but if you do shop at farmers markets and things, I find that farmers can be an incredible source of ideas for how to prepare various things. So I guess those are a few of my, and then tasting. The other thing about cooking that I don't think I talk about enough and a lot of people is when you're learning to cook, obviously cooking is really important, but tasting as you go, tasting your ingredients. I talk about this in All About Dinner, my latest book, but just starting, you know, throughout the whole process, tasting as you're going, and you're going to learn so much about the process if you do it that way.
Thanks a lot for that call, Timothy. We're talking to cooking teacher and cookbook author Molly Stevens about mainly potatoes on this edition of Food Friday. Her books include One Potato, Two Potato, and her most recent, All About Dinner. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite potato, a favorite potato dish? Do you need some general cooking advice, especially dinner-related cooking advice from Molly? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page and find a couple recipes from Molly at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up, we'll check out another fancier roasted potato recipe. At least it looks fancier. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday talk with Molly Stevens, author of the cookbooks One Potato, Two Potato, and All About Dinner, among others. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your potato favorites or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Hayward. Tom, hi.
Hi. Say, I was wondering, in your opinion, what's the best potato for potato salad? When I make it, I typically make about, 5 pounds of potatoes. And I use celery, radishes. For every potato, I put in an egg and a red onion and mayo and then a little sour cream. And it's very good, Lowry seasoned salt. But the next day, it's runny. And I was wondering, am I using the wrong potato? I usually use, like, russets or something.
Hmm. Interesting, Tom. Sounds delicious. Molly, any thoughts for Tom?
Yeah. Tom, thanks for calling. You said you use russets generally?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, by the way, your salad sounds great. Sounds like a real classic. And the russet is going to be, I find, a little soft for potato salad, it'll lose its shape a little bit more quickly. So what you might try is going with what we call a red potato or a boiling potato. Some people call it a waxy potato, but the sort of Yukon Gold is another thing. It's kind of a medium starch potato, so it's going to give you a little bit more of that soft texture that you might be used to with your russet, but it's going to hold up a little bit better. So I would say try using a red or white kind of boiling potato, and that might hold up a little bit better. The other thing is it depends on how you said you're using radishes and celery, and those things can start to weep a little bit when it sits in the dressing, especially if there is a lot of that seasoning salt. So, every potato salad that's got that's well seasoned and has a little bit of fresh vegetables, fresh crunchy things will weep a little bit, but it shouldn't get super soggy. So another thing you could do is you could just lightly dress the potatoes that you want to eat that day, that most of them, and save the rest and dress them the next day. Those would be two ways around it.
Tom, thanks a lot. Hope that helps. Before we go back to our callers, Molly, I want to check out another recipe you shared. Again, it's at WPR.org/Food Friday. Mustard crusted roast potatoes. Sounds really good. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah, well, I wanted to sneak that one in, Rob, because I wrote a book all about roasting, so obviously I'm a big fan of roasted food. And this, the mustard crusted roasted potatoes, it almost, speaking about Tom's potato salad, almost looks like a potato salad before you put it in the oven, because you put a pretty good amount of mustard and olive oil and a little bit of lemon juice. So it's almost like a raw potato salad and then you put it on a sheet pan or a baking sheet and put it in the oven and roast it at a pretty high temperature. And it gets super crunchy. Those really killer French fries that almost have a crust on them. It's reminiscent of that, but it's got all this flavor in it. So it's a really wonderful, a way to kind of, fancify or dress up your basic roast potatoes. And for that, I do use like a red potato.
And I got to ask, what kind of mustard? We've got a whole museum here in Wisconsin and Middleton about mustard. Which kind of mustard goes into this potato dish?
Well, that would be dealer's choice. It would affect how it would turn out. I like it with a Dijon, but I also like to mix Dijon and a whole grain. But I bet you've got some pretty nice, you know, honey mustards and sort of sweetened mustards out there that would do it too, that would work nicely too. You just want to be careful if you add something that's too sweet, it'll brown extra quickly because of those sugars.
Find that mustard-crusted roast potato recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll go back to your calls now. Patty is with us in Eau Claire. Patty, hello.
Hi. I make a sweet potato gnocchi, and after I boil the gnocchi, I fry it with vegetables, and I always end up, my gnocchi always ends up sticking to the pan, and I lose some of the potato on the bottom of the pan. Any suggestions about how to resolve that?
Great, Patty. So are you, after you cook the sweet potato, are you then mixing it with flour and things?
Yeah, so I cook the sweet potato, then I mix it with flour, a quarter cup of Parmesan cheese, half a cup of ricotta cheese, and then I mix it into a ball, and then you get the strings out, you know, you roll it out into a string, and then you cut it into gnocchi size.
Yep, and then you boil them, right?
I boil the gnocchi for about 2 or 3 minutes. And I'm just wondering I'm not drying the gnocchi enough before I put it into the pan.
Yeah, I would say a couple things. I would say you could try adding a little bit more flour, although you want, you know, as you know, the more flour you add, the tougher they're going to be. So if that feels like you have a nice texture, after you boil them, make sure you dry them and even lay them out on a clean dish towel or paper towels if you want, on a plate or a tray or a baking sheet, and really let them dry. I would even refrigerate them for a little bit if you have time, just to really dry them out. And then when you're sauteing them, just make sure you've got plenty of oil or fat or butter or something in the pan. If you do cook with a nonstick pan, that would be a super help there too. But just, I think if you could make sure they're cool and fully dry, that should help you quite a bit.
Thanks a lot for the call, Patty, at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking about potatoes with Molly Stevens, author of cookbooks including One Potato, Two Potato, and All About Dinner. Let's go back to your calls now with Donna in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Donna.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up?
I always make lefse, and of course I make it with russet potatoes, but someone said you can make lefse with sweet potatoes. I was wondering if your guest has ever tried that.
Wow. I've never made lefse with sweet potatoes, but now I want to try it. I think it's a great idea. The thing I would be, when you make your lefse, you want to tell people how you make it?
Well, I boil the potatoes and then I rice them and then I rice them again and then I rice them again and then add butter and all of the other ingredients and just add the flour just before I roll out the lefse.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. I think the thing I would caution with sweet potato is it doesn't have the starch of the russet potato, so it's going to be a lot wetter. So you're going to need to add more flour. One thing I think what I would try, and this is sometimes kind of goes back to Timothy's question, when I try to make changes to recipes, I often make incremental changes. Mm. So what I might do is I might make a half sweet potato, half russet potato lefse to start with and see how it goes and you know, judge that way. Because I'm afraid if I went all the way to a sweet potato the first time, it might just end up a big sloppy mess or I'd have to add too much flour. And then back to the gnocchi question, it's just going to be tough. So I think I'd start by trying a half and half, and it would get this pretty, really beautiful color and some of the sweetness from the potato, but still have that wonderful tender texture that you want in your lefse.
Donna, thanks a lot for that call. I want to take a couple minutes. Yeah, it was. A couple of minutes to talk about braising, Molly, which you've written a book about. We saw a piece you wrote about braising fall vegetables, potatoes, and sweet potatoes, and all the other great stuff that's up this time of year. First of all, could you just give us the basics of how we braise these root vegetables this time of year?
Right. Braised vegetables is such a... It's probably going to make some for supper tonight. When I started talking about braising, when I wrote the book all about braising, I thought I'd be braising all these big cuts of meat. And of course I did, but braised vegetables, you just get such incredible flavors, especially with all, as you mentioned, the root vegetables. So something as simple as a pan of braised potatoes, you just put a layer of potatoes in the bottom of a pan and add a few aromatics. Maybe it's a sprig of rosemary or a simple bay leaf, a little bit of, it could be water, it could be broth. And then a little bit of butter or olive oil, and just simmer it with a lid on over low heat till they're tender. And you just get, it's one of those things where the, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, just all these wonderful flavors and tenderness.
That sounds super good. Okay. I'm going to bring you a question that comes up in my life pretty often, Molly. I like to make oven fries. Sometimes they come out nice and crispy. Sometimes they're just sort of soggy fry shaped potatoes. Any advice on getting them crispy more or less every time?
Yeah, if you want, it's that happens to all of us. And potatoes, even though there's, it's russets classified as a starchy potato, those starches change during the season or change during storage. So if you want your oven fries perfect every time, you need to take a cue from the fast food and the restaurant pros. You need to twice cook them. So what I do is I parboil them. I cut them into sticks, you know, French fry sticks, parboil them, not till they're tender, but just so they're just starting to cook. Pull them out, drain them again. Then I coat them with a little bit of oil and into a hot oven. And you could do it a little bit ahead. But again, the same thing we talked about, you want to dry them out, we'll cool them down a little bit, and then into the hot oven. And you'll end up with crispy, brown, delicious French fries.
Whoa. Okay, I'm going to skip the rest of the show. I want to go try that right now. Know, Molly, right? Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Rob, it was great to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
You too. That's Molly Stevens, a Vermont-based cooking teacher, recipe developer, editor, and cookbook author. We talked to her today about a lot of the things she's written about. Her books include One Potato, Two Potato. Her most recent is All About Dinner. Hey, there's still time for you to share your Potato Land favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what you like. We actually heard from Darlene on Facebook, who says purple potatoes right out of the garden box, cooked with onions, curry powder, vegetable broth, canned whole tomatoes, and a splash of coconut creamer, cooked for 6 minutes in the Instant Pot. Simple, Darlene says, and awesome. Share your simple and awesome potato recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and check out recipes that Molly shared with us over at WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm going to try a couple of them at home, maybe as soon as this weekend. They sound really good. Also, share your ideas for future Food Fridays. Is there a food or cooking question you want answered, or just something you really like and want to hear more about? You can email your suggestions to ideas@WPR.org, and maybe we'll talk about it on a future edition of Food Friday. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, get the latest on resettlement efforts for Afghan refugees and visa applicants. Big part of that story happening here in Wisconsin. That and more Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. A lot of would-be homeowners spend lots of time searching for their dream house, but here's a chance to go the opposite way and purchase a nightmare house. As reported in the LA Times, there's a listing for the Los Angeles house that played a big role in the original Nightmare on Elm Street movie. In the movie series, deceased serial killer Freddy Krueger haunts the dreams of youth, often fatally. It was my first horror franchise that I latched onto as a youth. Now, you can live in that house. You have to move to L.A. It costs $3.25 million. The deadline for offers, Halloween. If it doesn't sell by then, real estate agents plan to hand out candy for trick-or-treaters. What will they do for a costume? Fun fact, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies were set in Ohio. The house for sale is in an L.A. neighborhood with no palm trees and a more Midwestern style of architecture. So it's often used as a local stunt double for Midwestern movies. 1-2, Freddy's got a deal for you. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the weekly World News Roundup from Australia to Haiti and beyond. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, we've been hearing each week on Central Time a new installment of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out, telling the story of how Republicans in the state drew legislative maps that helped to cement their majority. Spoiler alert, the state is getting new maps, and Republicans in the legislature released their proposed maps this week. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How big a deal are these legislative district maps to you? Is it a story you've been following, or have you just started to follow it? maybe thanks to the Mapped Out podcast. How should we draw these lines? Do you worry that they give one party or the other, depending on who draws it, a partisan advantage? And what questions do you have about how all this works and how it's going this time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. He's also co-host of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out, with Bridget Bowden. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
Well, you've been so immersed in 10 years ago, Sean. Now here's new news this week on these new maps. What are we seeing in these maps from Republican lawmakers?
A little bit of history repeating itself in that 10 years ago, they drew a very strongly Republican map. And what they've presented this year is a very strong Republican map. You know, there was some talk, at least among some Republicans, that given that this is going to be decided by a court, most likely in the very end, that you might see kind of a different map presented by the Republican legislature. But I would say basically you have a very strong Republican map here. You know, Republican gerrymander in the proposal that they've released just as they had a decade ago.
We have another set of maps out earlier this month from the governor's People's Maps Commission. What kind of things did they come up with?
The People's Maps Commission, it was established by a Democratic governor, and so I think there was some thought that it might go the other direction, you know, that you might have Democratic maps. And, I mean, those maps are definitely better for Democrats than the existing map or the one that Republicans have proposed. But you do see a bit of a Republican lean in the state legislative races for the draft maps that have been released so far by this People's Maps Commission. And that's not because they set out to draw it, you know, leaning toward Republicans. It's because Wisconsin's political geography, where Democrats live more, you know, more in the dense cities of the state and Republicans are more spread out, does give Republicans an advantage when it comes to map drawing. So they ended up with, I think one of their scenarios was like a 53% Republican lean in the state assembly map. Not as strongly Republican as we have by now, right now by a long shot, but still you kind of see the situation we're in here in Wisconsin.
Now, an important distinction, this map drawn by lawmakers is part of the regular map making process. This People's Commission map, it's just sort of an outside thing, right? It's not part of the usual way these things are done.
At the end of the day, it's going to be a suggestion. I would expect that there will be a Democratic lawmaker when the legislature debates redistricting who will produce it as an amendment and say, hey, let's vote on this. Let's pass this instead. Let's give this an up or down vote. But the legislature is under no obligation to do it. You can also see the People's Maps Commission maps becoming relevant if and when this goes to court, where they could present this to a court and say, look, we did this out in the open. Here's our homework. Here's how we arrived at this. You, court, should choose this plan over what passed the legislature.
Talking to Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief, about redistricting maps. Republican lawmakers released their initial maps just this week. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Sean, you mentioned this could end up in court, and one of the main ways that could happen, as has happened so many times in Wisconsin before, the governor could veto whatever the Republicans end up putting on his desk. Does that seem likely at this point?
He's sending pretty strong hints, the governor is, that he's going to veto this map if this is what passes the legislature. Essentially put out a statement yesterday or when the maps came out saying, hey, you're going to have to do better than this if you want me to sign this. He referred to them as gerrymandering 2.0. And he's previously said that if it's gerrymandering 2.0, I'm going to veto it. So he's not leaving a lot of mystery there. The governor is not, when it comes to how he's going to receive these maps.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Shawano. Steve, hi.
Yeah, hi there. I hope you can hear me. I'm on a cell phone. I probably might lose you here in the woods. I have a real problem with the whole idea of gerrymandering, because I really think it's, you know, citizens unite in gerrymandering. I think, you know, the two greatest threats to our democracy. And the problem I have with gerrymandering is it's based on politics, not population. And I think the simple solution is that everybody knows what county they live in. I live in Shawnee County. People live in O'Connell County. People live in Oneida County, Brown, et cetera. But ask them what assembly they, district they are. Ask them who's their senator, their state senator representative is. And their eyes will glaze over because they don't know. And if you look at the maps of the various assemblies and House of Representatives district lines, they're just incredibly oddball, obtuse forms that just are just nonsensical. I mean, there's some districts where they'll have portions of like six or eight counties in one district. And then, but then the other representative district is totally diverse from that. So anyhow, what I think the simple solution is you take the census numbers and you plug it all into a data in a computer, and then you let the computer pick the districts. And it's based on population, and you use county lines as a primary means of differentiation. And if you have to break up a county like Milwaukee or Dane or Brown or something like that because of population, then you can get down to the township. Or if you're in a municipality, you can use precincts. But you use existing, you know, district line or, you know, lines of demarcation. You know,
Gotcha. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And Sean, as I've learned from the podcast Mapped Out, those lines of demarcation are supposed to be at least one of the criteria used already, right?
Yeah, it is one of those criteria that is extremely subjective, though, because you're going to have to break someone up. And so if you prioritize that criteria, it might come at the expense of something else. You know, Republicans actually are pointing to their map and saying we would actually break up fewer communities than, you know, than the People's Maps Commission map. And yet they have a much stronger Republican lean to their map. So they're trade-offs. There are trade-offs every time. And just prioritizing like county lines and local government lines above all else can have unintended consequences.
Thanks for that call. Sean, I know at various points mathematicians have gotten involved trying to make more neutral maps. I mean, is there such a thing as like an objective map that, you know, nobody has to put their finger on a scale at any point?
The People's Maps Commission is working with a nationally renowned mathematician, actually, to draw their maps. And part of the way that they drew it is they said, we want to have one of the factors we look at be partisan fairness. We want to have this map when all these other criteria are satisfied, you know, equal population, don't break up communities. We also want to favor a map that more resembles Wisconsin in statewide elections. That is, we are a 50-50 state. We should have a legislature that kind of bends that direction anyway. And you see what happens when you kind of plug all that in, you put one of the brightest math minds in the country in charge of the process, or at least give her a seat at the table. I'm not sure it's the kind of thing where you can just plug it into a computer and spit out the right answer that's going to please everyone.
And briefly, Sean, as we wrap up, what is next on the mapping timeline?
There's a public hearing in the legislature next week on the Republican map. It's on Thursday. I don't know yet when the legislature is going to pass their plan. I would presume a governor veto pretty soon after that. And then, you know, whenever the legislature and the governor are done with what they're going to do, the state Supreme Court gets the first shot at this.
Sean, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, co-host of the WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out. More coming on Wisconsin redistricting, including some of the legal angle that Sean was just touching on. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the way maps are drawn, the way they were drawn last time? What would you want to see, if anything, work differently about all of this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about redistricting. Currently in process here in Wisconsin, Republican lawmakers released their proposed maps earlier this week. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Robert Yablon is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School. His research interests include political and election law, constitutional law, federal courts, and statutory interpretation. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here. Happy Friday.
Well, let's pick up where I left off with Sean there. A likely veto from Governor Evers on this Republican-drawn map. State courts, he said, would get the first crack at it. Why is that? I know in the past, a lot of our maps have ended up being decided by federal courts.
Well, I think the answer mainly is because they are indicating this time around the state Supreme Court that they are willing to do the work. And there is some precedent from the U.S. Supreme Court suggesting that when state actors, whether we're talking about state political actors or state courts, are in fact moving forward to try to draw district lines, then federal courts should typically take a back seat. And so right now there are pending lawsuits in the state Supreme Court and in federal court. The federal lawsuit is kind of on pause at the moment, and it's that state Supreme Court lawsuit that is taking center stage right now.
People have talked about courts ending up drawing new maps, which has happened in Wisconsin in the past. One possible outcome, though, Rob, check me if I'm wrong, the lawmakers could pass their map, the governor could veto it, it ends up in the state Supreme Court. The state Supreme Court could theoretically say, yeah, Republican map, we love it, sign off on it exactly as drawn. That's one possible outcome, right?
The map that the legislature is going to pass here in the coming weeks is presumably one that they'll present to the state Supreme Court. And one option for the state Supreme Court would be to just sign off on that map. Yes.
What are some of the things that end up being argued about in a court, state or federal, when it comes to these maps, when they're disputed by the two different branches, two other branches of government?
Right. Well, you know, the obligation that a court has is to ensure that the maps comply with a number of federal and state legal principles. And so there's going to be a lot of debate between, you know, we're going to get a lot of maps submitted, maps from the legislature, the People's Maps Commission maps, and a number of other litigants will probably come in with their own maps. And there's going to be discussion about which of those maps do the best job complying with the requirements that the law sets out, and that also maybe do the best job on some discretionary criteria that you might hope to have in a map, such as partisan fairness. So by law, federal law, you have to have districts that are relatively equally populated. You have to comply with the Voting Rights Act, which is meant to ensure electoral opportunities for large and politically cohesive minority groups. Then as a matter of state law, you need to ensure that you're drawing districts that are contiguous and as compact as is practical, and you want to try to minimize the number of times that you're splitting political subdivision boundaries. So all of that gets thrown into the mix, and the court needs to try to figure out which submitted map fits the bill best, or whether it needs to do some of its own mapping.
A key point in all of that, though, is the argument over gerrymandering is the partisan slant that a map can give. There's not really any law against that, though, right, at the state or federal level. That, even going up to the U.S. Supreme Court, hasn't led to maps being thrown out, at least by federal courts, over partisan gerrymandering. Do I have that right?
That's right. Federal courts have said that this is just not something they're going to regulate. And so that means that state lawmakers have pretty free rein to seek to tilt the playing field in one partisan direction or another. There are some states in which the state Supreme Courts or lower state courts have said as a matter of state law that there are some limits on partisan gerrymandering. That isn't something that has really been litigated directly in Wisconsin to this point. So there is right now no law on the books that would constrain attempts at partisan gerrymandering here in Wisconsin.
Right. In my memory, I think Pennsylvania's, I think state Supreme Court had said, hey, you got to redraw the map. And I think a North Carolina map, if I'm not mistaken. So we have seen state courts, as you say, back to the drawing board on maps over the issue of partisan gerrymandering.
Yes. I mean, those are the two big recent examples, Pennsylvania and North Carolina.
Talking to Rob Yablon from the UW Law School about Wisconsin's map drawing system here for our political boundaries. Big story this week, Republicans in the legislature out with their initial map proposal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to our callers. Barb is with us in Madison. Barb, hi.
Oh, hi. I'm your first caller, I guess. Thanks. I have been trying to follow the gerrymandering movies and workshops and learning about what gerrymandering actually means to the average citizen of Wisconsin. And it's very complicated and a lot more, it affects a lot more of us than we realize. And I think we should fight tooth and nail for a nonpartisan district. It doesn't do us any good to have pro-Democratic or pro-Republican districts, because then our legislators don't have to listen to our constituent voices. And I've been very irritated with Ron Johnson at the federal level and Robin Voss at the state level, who doesn't care about what I care about, and he doesn't respond with any real interest in the way that I think or care or my opinion. So
Barb,
it's really...
Got it, Barb. Thanks a lot for the call. Barb gave us a lot to work with there. Rob, first of all, the idea, and I've heard this argument advanced, that a gerrymandered legislature in particular means that lawmakers don't have to represent part of their constituency. They don't have to look over their shoulders because they know that their party is very, very likely to win their district.
Yeah, there's no question that gerrymandering affects the way that the state is governed. It means that there are fewer districts that are competitive, more safe seats. That can mean that there is less electoral accountability. It can mean that the representatives who are voted into office are the ones who represent the extremes of one party or the other. So less room for centrism and negotiation. And, and that might mean that there's just less room for compromise in the legislature. And all of that can affect, the way that the citizens of the state experience politics. And I think you heard a little bit of that with the caller. I mean, gerrymandering certainly contributes to cynicism and disaffection and maybe even disengagement among some members of the electorate.
And Barb also mentioned having a neutral party or some kind of outside party apart from, the legislature and the governor draw these maps. There are states where it works like that, I think, including like Iowa and Colorado. What other models are there for drawing these lines?
Yeah, there are a growing number of states that have tried to take redistricting at least partly out of the hands of the legislature. The Iowa model is one that's often held out there as a model where you have nonpartisan staff members of the legislature who draw lines without any reference to political criteria, and they've had that in place for several decades in Iowa. There are newer models in states, you mentioned Colorado, but also California, Arizona. They have tried to create nonpartisan commissions. You can use bipartisan commissions as well. And again, if you have criteria that try to disassociate the map making from politics and you give those nonpartisan or bipartisan commissioners other criteria to focus on, then maybe that also can result in some fairer maps.
Thanks for the call, Barb, at 800-642-1234. Rob, one interesting thing that came out of the People's Maps Commission was some of their map recommendations still had a Republican lean, not as strong as the one drawn by Republican lawmakers. And people have been pointing to the idea that Democrats tend to cluster in larger cities, and that makes it harder to draw pro-Democratic maps in a natural way. Is that something you're seeing? Is that part of the story here?
I think that is part of the story that you're seeing from the People's Maps Commission maps. The political geography of Wisconsin probably does lean modestly in the Republicans' direction because of the packing of Democratic voters in Madison and Milwaukee. That political geography certainly doesn't require anything like the gerrymandered map that we've had for the past decade, which takes that sort of modest Republican leaning and really exaggerates it to a much greater extent. And it is possible, and I think the People's Maps Commission has shown this, it's possible to get much closer to proportional representation while still having districts that are quite compact and do a pretty good job respecting political subdivision boundary lines.
Let's bring on another caller now. Chris is with us in Appleton. Chris, hi.
Hi, thank you. My question is, when was the last time Wisconsin had a more proportional legislature, 50-50 Republican-Democrat?
Thanks for the call, Chris. And I know after 2010, before the new maps were drawn, the Senate was really close because briefly a couple Senate recalls were enough to flip it from Republican to Democratic control. So that's we've had close divides in the legislature in years past, Rob.
That's right. I mean, in the 1980s, the 1990s, and the 2000s, all of those maps were drawn by courts, and they were relatively neutral maps. They were maps in which if it was a good year for Democrats, the Democrats had a real chance of controlling the legislature, and vice versa for Republicans. So it was that the map that was adopted in 2011 replaced what had been a more neutral court-drawn map.
Thanks a lot for that call. Rob, one big question. People point toward a conservative majority on Wisconsin's Supreme Court, and Democrats might worry that that means they're more likely to go along with a Republican map. Is it that simple?
I don't think it is that simple. You know, I think that there are, we do think of our Supreme Court as one that is a 4-3 conservative majority, but those four justices are not uniform in their views. Although they often side with the Republicans in the legislature on important issues, they don't always. And so, you know, they will do the legal analysis here, and it is possible that they may find that they are going the legislature's way, but they're going to feel some pressure, I think, from both the law and the citizens of this state, many of whom I think want a more neutral map, to do something maybe a little bit different from what the legislature is asking for.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Good to be with you.
Rob Yablon is an associate professor in the UW Law School. We talked to him about some of the legal questions behind Wisconsin's redistricting process after we saw maps released this week by Republican lawmakers. Coming up Monday on Central Time, there's a new space race as countries around the world prepare for the orbital businesses of the future and for conflict in Earth's orbit. And we'll learn why the world of modern surfing owes a debt to Wisconsin. That and more. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll dig deep into the science of fungus with mushrooms and more. A UW fungus expert shares highlights from this year's Wisconsin Science Festival with a focus on the strange species of the fungal world. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.